Welcome back to Livia Matters with me, Mae Thompson.
And me, Ilham Saoudi.
We've come to the end of our Women, Peace and Security season, and we've aimed to open a conversation that is honest and reflective, and we want to take a moment before we go with you, our audience, to reflect on where we are and what we can all do to ensure the rights, freedoms and participation of women in peace and political processes. It is such a broad topic, and over the past 8 episodes, so many challenges and barriers have come up, so it often feels like groundbreaking solutions are needed, but actually change can be much more incremental, and it needs to be. And this is something that has been a tough truth for me to learn working in advocacy. So one of the main things that we've talked about is the participation of women in transitional processes. And to really circle back to Libya, Ilham, I wanted to ask you, what are the main challenges you see today, particularly in the run-up to rumored elections, of women in Libya engaging in the political process?
I think there is two levels to that, because there is what's happening in the sort of ongoing political process and then what happens in the elections. Because I think it's easy to, again, disenfranchise women today because we're focusing on the future and then we don't know what's going to happen in the future. You know, one of the main reasons, in my opinion, for why none of the political processes have stuck is because they are so tokenistic in so many ways and in so many levels, whether that's with regards to women, but also with regards to ethnic minorities, including diversity in terms of age, in terms of background, in terms of experience. And I think that's one of the flaws. And we seem to be repeating with every single transitional process really the similar mistakes. And I think on the women front, you know, one of the things as we've been listening to these episodes together and thinking about some of the themes that came up is really the design element of these processes, because we often focus on the event itself, right? So that's what gets covered in the media in Libya. That's what gets talked about. But actually, by then, it's done, because it's how you design it that matters. And if we think about the last process, the Libyan political dialogue forum, you know, a lot of the meetings happened in Geneva. Some happened in Tunisia, but the majority happened in Geneva and for very extended periods of time. And I think it's one of those things where, well, of course, not every woman can be able to do that. You know, if you have young children, if you are from a rural, you know, environment, which will take you longer there and back and requiring so much travel in a way that isn't designed to accommodate women, meant that a certain group of women, which by many will be perceived as a certain elite, were the ones in the room. And I can speak for myself, I wasn't representative. You know, I couldn't be there to speak on behalf of women, because what's my reference point in that conversation? And so I think when we're thinking about design, it's not just about the numbers, although the numbers are vital. Like, you know, it is about ensuring that there is a proper representation in terms of numbers, but it's also ensuring that there is more inclusion across the numbers and that the conditions are conducive for genuine participation. You know, the point you made, I think, way back in the early episode is having meetings in the evenings or having meetings ad hoc that, you know, you can't set up childcare for. I speak for myself, for the final part of the LPDF, I was the only person remote because I had a really young daughter and I was on my own and I couldn't drag her to Geneva with me. And so, you know, simple things like childcare, which seems strange to mention in the context of a political process.
Yeah.
But it makes a difference. And, you know, I can give an example here in the UK where, you know, there needed to be a change in the way that parliamentary committees were meeting. Because a lot of the times the committees were meeting in bars in the evenings when women had already gone home because of childcare. And it was just thought, well, you know, you're not committed to the job. You know, you should be here if you wanted to be part of this decision. And so these things happen everywhere in the world. So it's not, you know, it's not really as cultured as people would like to suggest to other this issue. But I think it's really important to kind of think about the practicalities, because that's where the real discrimination sometimes happens. But also in a wider design of, well, what do we really mean by participation? And thinking ahead to the elections, that means a really firmly revisiting all these electoral laws that are floating about and not fixate just on the quota, but, you know, also how you govern the way political parties work, right? It's not just what happens in the national level, for example, You know, there needs to be clarity that, you know, political parties have to have a certain representation, that they need to put forward female candidates, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot to discuss. And I think one of the things that makes me anxious is none of these conversations are being held publicly. Some of them are being held in small convenings and roundtables, again, with a very specific group of, if someone said to me, oh, there's a meeting discussing women's participation in the elections, I could fairly say I could name at least 60% of the people in that room. And that's wrong. And so I think the number one thing I would say about all these processes, whether it's drafting laws, like we've seen this violence against women law, that's, you know, that it's a very strong draft that's being discussed at the moment, whether it's electoral laws, whether it's political processes, the consultative process cannot be underestimated. And UNSMIL, our UN support mission in Libya, constantly underestimates that, thinks it's a nice to have in the current environment. It's very box ticking. It's very elite. But, you know, genuine campaigns where people go out and understand exactly what's going on, prepare people, get consultative about what they actually want to be reflected, and then do that, doesn't happen. And so instead of, maybe if there's one takeaway, is let's not fixate on the outcome for once. And let's just fixate on the process, because in the process, there will be so many outcomes that are positive that even if the final outcome doesn't come along, we've made progress.
Yeah, and it seems almost like too basic to say that consulting women and people working on women's rights and participation, consulting them on what will actually make the process better. Like, it almost seems like it goes without saying that you would consult them on what is needed. But no, I think it's so true. It's so vital. And we see it, you know, it's not just in this issue when we talk about broadly, you know, any of the human rights issues that we work on, civil society being one of them, like actually consulting the people doing the work on the ground on what they need in order to be able to do their work is really important. Like, it's not just a nice thing to have. It's not just sort of a courtesy. It'll actually make the process stronger and better, especially civil society. This is something that we're doing a lot of work on as an organization, that, you know, we know that civil society in Libya is facing an intensified crackdown. And when we're talking about how we can be advocating to protect civil society so that they can operate freely and without hindrance, often, as you know, we sit here as both a Libyan and international organization, and as international organizations, there is often this lack of consultation of what is actually needed on the ground to protect those that are doing the work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it transcends just this, you know, women, peace and security issue, but more sort of broadly as well.
No, and what I think is fascinating about that is that, you know, you say rightly that this isn't sort of some, you know, out there idea that we consult with people, yet it is when we pitch it. You know, the amount of times we're building projects where we, you know, we want a consultation. I mean, let's talk, you know, within this topic of women, peace and security, a big part of the work we're doing now is trying to put together a working group of women who are working on these issues on the ground across the country to inform the processes that are going to come, right? And it was seen as this groundbreaking idea. I mean, that was, you know, phenomenal for our self-esteem that we came up with this incredible, but it's shocking that we're still having to explain the need for consultation. And I think when you're thinking about civil society, you know, the impact that we, when we talk about women, peace and security movement or women's rights in Libya, really that's part of a wider context of civil society. And so the crackdown you mentioned obviously impacts on women, and in some ways impacts on women far, far more greatly. Those ways are legal, because what we've seen in Libya is that the laws are applied differently to men and women. And so for, like, as a simple example, the cybercrime law, which effectively makes freedom of expression illegal online, has only been used, I think, 2 to 3 times to detain people, and they were women. It wasn't used to detain men. We've also seen that, obviously, societally, when civil society as a whole is tarnished as being morally corrupt, influenceable, a Western construct, in those definitions, of course, women will be seen as even more corrupt, as even more problematic. And there we've seen, a crackdown that includes restricting women's movements, significantly, We've seen, you know, a swelling in even public opinion justifying some of the restrictions on women in a way to protect them because they've been corrupted. And the minute that starts seeping into society as an acceptable narrative, then that's a massive impact. And I think that's where it's important for us to constantly be talking about these things, not just at the philosophical level or at the kind of work level or, at, you know, building advocacy for missions to go to Geneva or the like, but more day to day and with, you know, Libya Matters or even with Haqqani, which is our Arabic speaking podcast. It's really important for us to keep really highlighting this because it's become so normalized and accepted that civil society is silenced and so normalized and accepted that women are silenced. And we see that online as well, because as the kind of physical space became so hostile to women, we all retreated to the online space to do our advocacy, to do our work. And so has all the violence. And so a big area, and we talked about this with Noura in the season, is what's happening in the online space where people don't even recognize that as violence because it feels remote. And I think that's really, really dangerous.
And how do you continue trying to build a movement when, you know, not just women, but organizations, human rights organizations, civil society organizations, who are the only ones speaking out about these issues, if they continue to be silenced and targeted and disappeared and even worse, how do you then encourage people to take up that fight in a safe, and it seems like there is no safe way, right? Even if, as you said, when you go online, we've seen like the numbers are shocking that women especially are targeted, right, with the hate speech and threats and really awful sort of violence. So in a more sort of forward-looking way, what actually can be done?
Mm. Well, first of all, I don't think it's for us to encourage people or to tell them to do this, right? This is one of the, I think, misconceptions of our role. Because frankly, it's absolutely sensical that you wouldn't engage in this environment. And I think we need to be mindful of our role isn't there to, you know, ask people to do things. But I think what's important is to create the environment where that's possible. Separately, I don't think we need to encourage anyone because we don't have a shortage of civil society wanting to step up. And I think it's also kind of giving credit to that, right? They're not being prompted to do that. It's happening.
No, yeah, apologies. Yeah. Perhaps the encourage was the wrong word, more like facilitate, I guess.
No, but I think it is important to use that language and to reflect on it because it is used constantly. Like, oh, you know, can we talk a little bit about pet peeves?
Yeah.
Because I think for me, this kind of language of let's empower civil society, you know, the amount of times we've had to edit statements or questions that even come to us from policymakers about, oh, you know, what are you doing to empower women in Libya? I'm like, I don't need to do anything to empower women in Libya. I just need to, you know, talk to people like you who are kind of obstacles to their self-propelled work. What I need to do, or what we need to do as LFJL, is be there to support what is required, provide an environment through advocacy to be pushing for these things, and also to sort of be humble enough to admit what we don't know and to give the space that we do have and we should recognize we do have to those who do know. And I think that's one of the things that has been really exciting in this coming period because, you know, when we were doing the mapping for women's organizations in Libya to work with, there are so many incredible ones. And I think it was so, it seems obvious to say, but I think, yeah, this whole narrative that we keep hearing, like, how do you empower this movement? How do you make space? I mean, it's not about those things. It's, you know, there is agency and there is phenomenal work that's being done. What needs to be tackled are those who are using legal tools within the country to prevent this and go after them. And that's something we can do, whether it's through advocacy or whether that's through legal routes, to expose it through sort of, you know, research, reporting, etc. And to call out the international actors who are either complicit in this or enabling this proactively. And I think that's what we can do. But civil society is good. It's healthy. It's big. It's willing. And it's very much able. We just need to get the people in the way of civil society out of the way.
Yeah. And I wanted to just pick up what you said around the international community, absolutely urging them to do what they can to, you know, put pressure on the Libyan authorities to abide by their obligations, but also for the international community, like linking it back to the Security Council where we have this WPS agenda, like the framework is already there. So it's being able to hold them accountable to what their duties are to ensure that women can be part of these transitional and peace and justice processes in Libya or, you know, in other contexts as well.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to recognize that the, you know, WPS agenda is binding on all countries and it's at the Security Council level as a primary agenda. And so, and let's be blunt here, you know, we know that a lot of people that listen to us are the people who sit around the, you know, on the Libya sessions, or at least are advising those sitting around the table in New York for the Libya settings. It is not a favor. It is not a request. It is a requirement that women are at the table, not that they might or that you'll try or that you'll endeavor, because that's actually part of your mandate if you're a Security Council member or if you're even a member state of the United Nations. And so I think it's also, I think, changing the language of how this is talked about, because so much, for example, in the last couple of years has been focused on putting in place a national action plan for Libya in Libya. And the fact that, you know, there were issues with that, there was problems or obstacles with that, became an excuse not to engage on this fully. And so then all the kind of resources around this became low-level engagement. And I think that comfort with incompetence and failure that the international community in Libya has needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. This kind of narrative of Libya is a failed state, it's not on us that we can't make this work, is boring. And so I think there needs to be a real genuine recognition, A, that there's a duty and an obligation to engage in this file fully. And secondly, that that needs to be reflected in their policy, but also in their programming. And so if they're talking about WPS at the Security Council, they need to be putting their money into WPS in Libya.
Yeah, absolutely. And building on what you said, engaging fully, but also holistically, so not... And we see this a lot, right? Human rights always and women's rights comes below everything. Like you're prioritizing politics and your, you know, the political process, and you're prioritizing, you know, the economic track. Like, you know, human rights always comes last and it's separated. And the same we see like with the WPS agenda, like, and you even said it, I think at the beginning, like, I hate this word agenda. Like, why is it a separate item in its separate box somewhere over there? Like, it needs to start being mainstreamed throughout every single international or domestic initiative.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of our work cut out for us. So when we're thinking about next steps, I think, you know, if there's a genuine conversation about elections, there needs to be a genuine, parallel, continuous conversation about, great, how are these going to address this issue? And I think that needs to, like we said, involve consultation, but also education. And when we're talking about Libya's preparedness for elections, you know, whether it's the Libyan authorities, the Libyan National Election Commission, the international overseers, so UNSMIL, the UN, individual states, the preparedness is always made by reference to logistics, right? Are there going to be enough polling booths? Are they going to be safe? Well, let's take a moment. Are they going to be there? How are we going to print the ballots? How are we distributing the ballots? That's the checklist they're going through. And even if we just, you know, we say we don't want it to be a checklist. In this thing, we need it to be part of the checklist, right? There is nothing in there about a conducive environment for the elections. Like, is there actual freedom of expression in the country so that we can vet these candidates and be able to say, this person is implicated in this, or, you know, just being able to expose it, because there's zero protections around that. Freedom of association is not protected. And so how are you even able to, for example, establish a genuinely independent political party that might be moving the needle on this forward if you can't really associate freely without getting certain permissions from the current government to set up a political party? Assembly, so that people can go out and protest against things that are not in line with what they want for the elections. Any kind of vetting process at all for candidates. And so I personally... I'm less interested in how many ballots we can print if it means that the names that are going on the ballot have not been vetted, are not inclusive, and the people voting are not informed and have not been able to access information, not because of their lack of interest, but because of a system created to have an election in darkness.
And how do we... It seems so doom and gloom, and there is this real push, right? It seems like it's, especially from Ansel, right, that it's so important that we achieve this by a certain time. Like, the emphasis is really on getting it done and getting it done as soon as possible. So what would the first steps be, I guess, for, if we're talking not about, you know, policymakers or civil society, for the general public, for example, how can they start to turn the dial, I guess, on creating this type of environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of layers to that, because on some level, the public, understandably, has disengaged.
Yeah, of course.
Because there's been so many failed attempts. There's been so much disingenuity in the process. A lot of their basic needs on some levels, according to polling, et cetera, seem to be met on some level in terms of, like, you know, electricity outages, et cetera. These really practical things have been addressed. And, you know, we as Libyans have learned how to be resilient in dysfunctioning states, right? And so somehow there is this element of, we've made this work, let's just get on with life, that I understand. But I think the flip side of that is, I guess what we need is more space for civil society to do its work, because they will be the ones that turn around the public. It won't be policy or governments that do that. But if the government and the policies were made to stop the crackdown, and that's not hard, because all it takes is some of these states to say, if you want to be at the political process, Dbeiba, Haftar, you have to repeal these laws. It's not that hard. Doesn't cost money. It's not a NATO intervention. It's none of those things. It's just putting preconditions for the table. But there's such fear of having genuine repercussions for not doing things. And so, you know, if there's one thing to take away from the Libyan process, is that the entire political process to date has been created, sustained, designed based on incentives as opposed to disincentives. And that has not worked. And I think what there needs to be now is more of a stick to say, well, if you don't do this, then you don't get to play the game. And I think those things do have impact. And so if we have that kind of shift, then civil society always fills the gap in Libya. I mean, look at, like, on a complete tangent, but look at Derna. You know, we started off the season talking like Derna's one. It wasn't the state that went out and helped identify the bodies and helped to clean up the city and help to, you know, shelter people and provide basic humanitarian assistance. It was the Libyan Boy Scouts. It was Libyan civil society. And so Libyan Scouts, because there were a lot of Girl Scouts there too. And so I think it's not that, the civil society will do its work. It just needs the space to do it.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up Derna, and maybe we can just, like, take a moment there as well, because I think we saw, like, it was such a illustration, I guess, of, like, of course, on the surface, when you look at the event, it seems like just, you know, the flooding and a natural disaster and, you know, a terrible humanitarian crisis. However, you know, it became quickly very clear that this was a result of years and years and years of disenfranchisement, but also of negligence, of corruption. And very quickly, as you said, civil society taking that sort of humanitarian role, but also then taking to the streets in protest, saying, you know, very adamantly that they did not trust the Libyan authorities to conduct any sort of fair investigation into what happened, and calling on the international community to do some sort of independent inquiry. And there is zero accountability. And I think before we can, not before, because as you said, it's not a moment, it's not a question of sequencing, but there has to be an end to the cycle of impunity before women are able to fully enjoy their rights and participate.
And I think the Derna thing is also, if we want to, you wanted some optimism, right, in this final episode. I think Derna provides that, because it was such a powerful moment of people understanding in the most awful but tangible way why human rights matter. Because it was a moment where every single right was damaged in Derna, you know, kind of the right to having property, to having a home, to having clean water, to having sanitation, to being able to access healthcare, education, everything, the whole suite was impacted by it. And it wasn't obviously political. And And so it was a real moment for Libya that I don't think we've seen since 2011 of people coming together and saying this doesn't work. No one is making excuses for this. And so I think this is a moment, and I think the window is still there for this to be an impetus for people to say, we're not buying this BS anymore, and that there needs to be a proper process in any process. And you're seeing that, you know, it did have an impact because it terrified those in power. They were more focused on coming and disowning the blame than anything else. And so that fear of accountability is there. So I think that's a moment. And I think if you're thinking about this in the wider scope, civil society's work by coming out with clear demands in the midst of this to have that clarity of mind to say, this is what we want, to also fill the gap. It showed what the society, what Libyan society really is, which is that it's very clear on what it wants, actually, is very adamant to have it and is capable. And so I think if we take those three together, now is the moment to just take a moment, I think, in this podcast and first of all, be in awe and grateful for that. And also think, okay, how do we apply this to the wider scene? We do have an election coming up. How do we transform this political class? And what do we call from it? And so if we're talking about calls to action or, you know, what we should be doing together, I think, you know, it's very clear what the international community has done. We touched on that now. They know their duties. They're willfully ignorant of them. But I think it is really important for us to continue to hold them to account. The Libyan state is also aware of these things, and it's really important that we keep pointing the mirror to that. And I think it's really worth us constantly thinking of ways of making the space safe. How do we do that? These laws have to be abolished. So Law 19, 2001, which is a Gaddafi-era law that has been reactivated by the current government, needs to go. You know, all the provisions that make civil society work a capital offense in our penal code need to go. The cybercrime law needs to go. The election laws, if we're looking forward, need to be very clear on inclusivity. It needs to be very clear on it than being facilitative. The process needs to be ensuring that political parties that put forward candidates have also got to be inclusive for women, yes, for minorities, for disabilities, for everything, genuinely reflecting our actual community, our actual country. Those are not massive changes. The only thing that's massive about them is switching the political will. And that comes through, yes, incentives, which UNSMIL does very well by allowing all these people a chance to, you know, suggesting they'll all be allowed to run in this election, but also disincentives. And, you know, continuing to pursue accountability is a disincentive. Continuing to have civil society that speaks up. And so I think these changes are not overwhelming. They are necessary and they can happen. And some of them can just happen with a vote in parliament, in Libya, in the House of Representatives, or they can be done by decree, all these decrees that have been passed can be cancelled equally easily. It would take an afternoon to fix a lot of this on paper.
It does seem, when we sit and we talk about it, that it could be solved so easily. Obviously, if that was the case, you'd hope that it would have been done by now. But I think actually these issues that we see as major obstacles, actually you're right, if we just switch the political will, it's not as hard perhaps as we tell ourselves. When I say ourselves, I mean the actors involved in the process, that it is. I think that's a good sort of a nice way to tie it up. I just maybe wanted to ask you sort of a last question around, where does this leave us as an organization? I know that we say that we're committed to all of our work, but I don't know, having done this whole season and now we like beyond just doing this and then we close the door on it and we move on, actually, what can people expect from us?
Well, we can't move on because Marwa is here every single day. And so that is not an option for as long as she's in the organization. But joking aside, I think I hope we'll continue to try to practice what we preach and to be mindful of our own shortcomings. And that's fine. We, for example, are having our entire organization, not just our work, but the way we organize ourselves, the way we see funding, the way we set up our programs, all of that assessed from a gender perspective to see if we genuinely practice what we preach. I'm sure there'll be a lot that we learn from that we'll have to change our practices. You know, this is the first year where we've expressly and clearly stated that our priorities include bringing a feminist approach to the Libyan political process and to our work in general. And I think the reason we've stated this publicly is because we want to be held accountable for this as well. And working with so many phenomenal women's organizations, I know we will be held to account because we've placed ourselves in a situation of saying, we're a facilitator of this, so we will be supporting this, so we'll be funding that. And so if we're going to put ourselves out in that role, then we also need to be there to receive the accountability that comes from that. And I'm personally looking forward to us becoming stronger as a result, becoming more humble as a result, and to have a network that is loud and clear and unrelenting and unforgiving in this process, to ensure that the next round of politicians don't look like this.
Absolutely. And also safe and protected, right?
And on a super personal level, like, you know, we all do this for our personal reasons. I want to be in a situation where I can go home and bring my daughter with me.
Wow, maybe a more emotional finish than I would have wanted.
Thank you. Thank you, May.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for indulging our pontification sometimes. We're grateful for all the support. And who knows, maybe one season soon we'll be doing it from Ghdamis or Sabha or Tripoli or Benghazi or Derna. So please continue to support us and continue to listen. And please send us questions and ideas for future seasons. Till then.
Bye. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. You can find more information, including where to find us on social media, in the show notes. Libya Matters is brought to you by Lawyers for Justice in Libya and produced by Damiri Media. This season is hosted by Alham Saudi, Mara Mohammed, Mara Ben Abdurazak, and Mae Thompson. It is produced and edited by Al Shibani, with sound design and mixing from Hafid Drabi. This season of Libya Matters was made possible by contributions from the LFJL team, including Alexandra Azua, Rahimna Abdurazak, and Hasna Al-Jamali.